Good day, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, hosted by Tara Anjaria out of Bombay, India. A few weeks ago, Caroline Stolte had talked to us about her new book on Indo-Dutch engagement. Today, we are going to have another academic talk to us about the Dutch in South Asia. Marcus Wink of the State University of New York is going to talk to us about his book, Mission to Madurai, Dutch Embassies to the Nayaka Court of Madurai in the 17th Century. In English and Dutch, extensively annotated and with a comprehensive bibliography, Marcus's book is yet another addition to the corpus of work on non-British colonialism in India. Over to Marcus.
Good morning, Marcus.
Hi, Dara. How are you?
I'm fine, and it's a pleasure to have you talking to us today, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm sure this interview will be a fantastic addition to our database.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's great. So, could you just tell us something about yourself before, you know, we get to the book?
Let's see. Well, I was born in the Netherlands, so I got my initial education there. And I think from early onwards, history has always been fascinating to me. And I think to a large extent it has to do with my teachers. So I think for many of us goes the fact that we owe what we are to a large extent to our teachers. And so I had a wonderful history teacher in high school even. And and then I went to college at Leiden, University of Leiden. I got my undergraduate degree there. And there was a wonderful group of teachers, professors there. I should mention Professor Gastra, Femme Gastra, a company historian, a historian of the Dutch East India Company. Professor Brown, teaching maritime history. And I also had the fortune of having actually an American teacher there, George Wenius. And so that was a wonderful group of people there. And so I graduated there many years ago, and then subsequently had to think about the rest of my life, what I was going to do. And fortunately, somewhere along the line, I met a through Wenius. He established a contact with Minnesota. He went to a conference somewhere and said he had this student looking for a graduate fellowship. And they said, well, fine, send in your application, which I did. And to make a long story short, that application was accepted. And that was in 1990. I went to the United States and went to the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. Had another wonderful group of people there, especially the early modern group. And I should mention a few names. My advisor, of course, James D. Tracy, Carla Phillips, and her husband, Wim Phillips, and also Stuart Swartz. So that was just some of the wonderful people that were present there. So I think if there's as an honor debt, then I should first start and mention those names. Yeah, and I graduated there in 1998, and then went on the market and ended up here in Fredonia. So that's 14 years ago. You're right.
So that's a long time.
That is a long time. Yeah, I'm sort of balancing the time in the Netherlands versus the time in the States, and if I'm doing my math correctly, I'm getting close to 50-50. 50% of my life here and 50% of my life over there.
So what does your research focus on?
Well, Mike, interestingly enough, I've always been fascinated with the so-called golden age, the 17th century. And just like in any other country, as a kid, you grow up with sort of the nationalist version of your country, and of course you go beyond that, but that sort of was the first spark, you know, the period when the Dutch Republic went overseas, was one of the great powers, and so we started from there, and then so gradually, so in Leiden I was exposed to maritime history and the Dutch East India Company through Professor Brown and Professor Gastra. And I did a master's thesis there on Malacca, the Dutch in Malacca. And I took that with me to Minnesota, but was advised there by, I think, Professor Phillips, who said that I should focus on a new topic. And at that time, I was working in the James Fort Bell Library, which is part of the campus, university campus, in the Wilson Library in Minnesota, and came across this box of documents, manuscript papers relating to the Dutch in India. And one of the documents that was in there was a description of the Nayaka state of Madurai by a VOC servant, and described as a resident in Tiruchirappalli. And that started me thinking, and especially because I knew that this area was relatively underexplored for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons was that this was sort of a border area between various jurisdictions of the Dutch East India Company. I mean, there are accounts of the Dutch in Ceylon, there are accounts of the Dutch in Coromandel, there are Dutch accounts of the Dutch in Malabar, but nothing really specific about Southeast India and Madurai in particular. And one of the problems, of course, is that in order to write a comprehensive account, you have to go through the records of all the different VOC administrations, because obviously they all relate to some extent to this area. So let's get the ball rolling. The simple manuscript that I came across in the James Fort Bell Library set the path towards my dissertation topic and some of my further research. And the book.
Yeah, so the book is basically an offshoot of your dissertation.
I like the offshore. Yeah, that's definitely offshoot or an offshore of my dissertation. It's actually my dissertation is something that I'm working on now as the next project. Maybe we can talk about it in a second. But yeah, this is really a small part, very small part of my dissertation research. My dissertation research was based on the contacts, interaction between the Dutch and the Nayaka state of Madurai in the second half of the 17th century. And of course, these embassies are part of this interaction that occurred during this time period. And fortunately enough, there were records preserved of these embassies.
So what I was wondering is about the book, and you chosen specifically to focus on the embassies, and that's actually it was a very formalized setting, you know. I mean, how much scope was there for negotiation, you know, like by the Dutch and, you know, talking to all these local kings. I mean, it wasn't like they were talking to the traders or something where the field was, you know, much more freer. So given this, why would you have chosen to focus on, you know, the embassies?
Mm-hmm. Well, embassies, of course, and I mentioned it right in the introduction, are basically the most spectacular subgenre of European travel literature, and have always spoken to the imagination of audiences, both contemporary audiences in the 17th century, but of course also in the present. So that's certainly one of the reasons. Now, these embassies themselves are interesting because they provide a certain human element to these interactions between these two, well, institutions or corporate entities, a state with its numerous officials, and on the other hand, the Dutch East India Company with its local representatives. So it's sort of an entry point into looking at mutual relations. So it's a starting point to further explore, to put that in a larger context. And that's what I do in the introduction, to sort of place these three embassies in the larger context of the interaction between these two groups, in particular the mutual perceptions that to some extent influenced these embassies, of course. Apart from the ambassadors themselves, and I make a few references to that in the introduction as well, how there are certain differences between these three ambassadors that allows us also to keep the human element in the historical narrative. And for me, that's very important. Of course, history is about larger forces and structures and contexts and limits of the possible, if you want to put it in Bodleian terms. But at the same time, we should also not forget that we as humans have continue to have a certain impact on the larger historical forces. So that's sort of this dialogue between these two that I think provides a very interesting setup for these embassies and the larger analysis of the interaction.
So could you just, tell us something about the book in a nutshell, especially about the accounts that you've chosen mm-hmm. to reproduce?
Right. So the accounts themselves are about three embassies that were sent by the Dutch East India Company into the interior of Southeast India, one in 1668, the second in 1677, and the third one in 1689. And the 1668 mission is the mission under Hendrik Adriaan van Reede, the future commander of the Malabar coast, and perhaps not unknown to some of the audience as someone who consigned the writing of the Cortes Malabaricus, and who also set up the educational system on the island of Ceylon in the 1690s for indigenous ministers, catechists. That's the first mission of 1668. At that time, both parties were basically set on a collision course. They were engaged in aggressive policies. At this point, and here you can see sort of the interaction between the larger forces and the human element, Van Reede is not particularly the best choice for an ambassador, certainly not in 1668, because right from the beginning he alienates the people that he meets through his, arrogance. He's a very interesting character. He, if you compare the three accounts to, this is the one that has, literally speaking, the greatest value. I mean, he's certainly educated. He has a certain level of appreciation for indigenous science and architecture, which of course is later translated in the Hortus Malabaricus. But at the same time, he's also someone who thinks very highly of himself, is abrasive, and that is apparent right from the beginning. So here we have a combination of larger forces, and that's what I try to explain in the introduction to that at this point, both parties are set on a opposite agenda that do not correspond well. And here you have this arrogant captain at this time, this point, a military captain, who stand out on this embassy and alienates his host. And then, of course, this sets in effect a series of events in while he is in Tiruchirappalli at the Nayaka Cap. His residence is attacked. And, of course, this could only have occurred with the connivance of the Nayaka authorities. So, communications are not ruptured at this point. Talks continue, but in the end, he basically leaves the capital and returns empty-handed. And next year, 1669, we have the outbreak of open hostilities. So this is sort of an event that certainly did not contribute to the improvement of relations, and in fact contributed to the deterioration. So that's the first embassy, and perhaps we can talk a little bit more about the larger context later. Second embassy of 1677 is the one that basically set off my journey on the path towards Madurai. This is the account that I, or at least an account that I encountered in the James Cabell Library in Minnesota. This is not so much a journal, but a description of the Nayaka State of Madurai that was produced afterwards. The actual journal, unfortunately, is, as far as I know, no longer existent. But we have this post-embassy report, that description that the ambassador wrote. And the ambassador, in this case, is an individual, a company assistant named Otto Buffing. And Buffing actually, right from the beginning, has carried a certain sympathy, for me at least. As an historian, you tend to identify with your topic to some extent. He is someone who started out as a military servant of the Dutch East India Company and then is transferred, obviously because he has certain qualities, literary qualities, to the civil administration of the Dutch East India Company. And he is picked in 1677, by the commander of the Madurai coast, the Dutch commander of the Madurai coast. And this attempt in 1677 is basically a last-ditch attempt by the company's imperialist faction to realize their agenda. And it is a last-ditch attempt because, as I also indicated in introduction, by this time there are a series of changes happening, including a castle revolution in Batavia, in the Dutch East India Company headquarters in Asia, where the imperialist faction loses out against a more moderate or mercantile faction. And so right before we see the change of the guard, the imperialist leadership in Ceylon sends out, tries to at least realize its agenda by sending out this embassy in 1677. But then, and this is really a turning point, while the ambassador isn't Tiruchirappalli, the leadership in Ceylon receives information or instructions, orders to recall the ambassador. All right? So Buffing is recalled. And so here we have another one of those moments, in this case in 1677, where these embassies provide an entry point also in measuring the relationship, the health of the relationship, and also the health of the parties. And by 1677, both parties suffer from overstretch, imperial overstretch. In a way, for these aggressive policies that they have pursued. The third, 1689, in a way, is, as far as the literary quality is concerned, the least interesting. It's produced by, again, a company assistant, relatively low official. His name is Welters, Nicolaas Welter. And this guy, basically your typical paper pusher, your bureaucrat, administrator, very unimaginative, very uncreative, and basically, and one indication of this is that when he reports these so-called conversations he has with officials of the Nayaka state, he literally verbatim reproduces the text of his instructions. So whether he really had those kinds of in conversations or he is just typically the unimaginative, creative paper pusher administrator is open to question. But this embassy is sent out at a time when things basically seem to go back to normal in the late 1680s for both parties. But there are larger forces at work, structural changes in the intra-Asiatic trade, in the Euro-Asian trade, that basically points to a change in change of the guard, where gradually not only the Nayaka state of Madurai is overtaken by the larger pan-Indian Maratha-Mughal struggle, and the Dutch are overtaken by the English and the French. So this is a gradual process, but there are clear indicators that things are changing for the Dutch here, and also for the Nayaka state. Okay, so these three embassies serve, as I mentioned, as entry points for the help of both parties, but also for the state of the relations between the two sides.
So the question here is, why were the Dutch, in fact, interested in engaging with the Nayaka Court? I mean, as you mentioned, Madurai, you know, it was inconveniently located.
Yes.
So what did they hope to get?
Yes. Well, what they tried to get, and this is kind of interesting, the consistency in the agenda of the Dutch East India Company during these three embassies. So over the course of, in this case, two decades or more, that they basically want the same things. They have a typical agenda, typical of a political merchant of the age of mercantilism. Right? So one of the things that they want is, of course, certain privileges as far as customs and tolls are concerned. They want, among other things, the exclusion of other Europeans from the area. And preferably also from some of their competitors, what they refer to as robbers or pirates, the Muslim Marakayar traders from the east and west coast of India. They also want certain safeguards for the merchants, for the weavers that they employ or to which they have advanced money in cash. And what they would like to have, too, is some kind of fortified settlement along the coast, the permission to fortify their main settlement, and in addition, perhaps the lease of some of the ports along the coast. So certain prerogatives that safeguards their position along the coast at the exclusion of others, of their rival, both European and Asian traders. And what they're interested in, among other things, of course, are textiles. So textiles are the main export produce of India, certainly. And in addition, there's also the pearl fishery, the chunks fisheries, but certainly textiles are the raison d'etre for the company presence here along the southeast coast of India.
And so the courts of Madurai were they in a position to help the Dutch achieve all this, because they were merely one of, you know, many regional kingdoms. So, I mean, what like gave them an edge over, I don't know, the other regional states?
First and foremost, the VOC, the Dutch East India Company, and what could, perhaps one should also explore what does Madurai want out of this. What we have here is a typical marriage of convenience, right? Both parties have little or nothing in common. They basically have very different agendas. Right. On the one hand, as I just mentioned, the VOC wants certain prerogatives. On the other hand, the Nayaka state basically wants to pursue an open, what could be described as an open door policy. Right. The more traders, the merrier. It wants to retain control over the coast. And so it's very wary. And in fact, staunchly opposed to the requests for a fortified settlement, and only in times of extreme fiscal emergency are they willing to allow the temporary short-term lease of some of the ports along the coast. So there's a basic clash of interests that exists between these two. They're very different agendas. But what they can have in common at times is converging political interests. And this, of course, takes place in what could be described as a South Indian Game of Thrones, perhaps. The VOC is one of the players. We have other European traders. But we also have a number of Asian actors here, of course. We have the Nayaka state itself, but also, most notably, the Tevar of Ramnath, one of the major, the most important, let's call it, for lack of a better word, vassals or independent-minded vassals of the Nayaka state. And we have also political merchants, portfolio capitalists, such as the Piriatambi Marakayara, right? So there is a whole array of forces. And then we have other Nayaka rulers in the area. So in times of war, when there is war between the various Nayaka rulers in South India, when the Nayaka state is at war with the Tevar, it starts to look for allies. And not only the Nayaka state is looking for allies, but also, for instance, the Tevars of Ramnad are looking for allies. So the VOC receives requests for military assistance or financial assistance. So there are times when, like I said, we can talk about a marriage of convenience, right? When the two have temporarily at least certain things in common. But overall, the agendas are very different from both groups.
You mentioned that, you know, you hope to contextualize in also the book the political situation in South India between the fall of Vijayanagara and the rise of Hyder Ali.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how do we actually, you know, what can we read about the situation, the political situation in South India during that period by looking at, you know, Dutch Nayaka interactions?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's say the political situation had been any different, you know, you think that there'd have been that much scope for this kind of engagement?
You're breaking up for a second. Can you hear me?
Pardon?
Okay. Oh, I couldn't hear your last word. But
yes.
You want to describe what's happening in the 17th century,
yes.
Is the relationship with Vijayanagara is not completely ruptured yet. And various authors have argued that as well, that this connection, the connection between the Nayaka state of Madurai and Vijayanagara, their titulary overlord, is never completely ruptured. This relationship is sort of described as a twilight zone kingship by symbolic subordination, but in fact practical independence, autonomy. So if we move a level below that, so we have a number of these so-called successor states in South India. And with a tremendous amount of rivalry, right, between these, if you think about Mysore, if you think about Madurai, but also Tanjavur, right, so there's a tremendous amount of rivalry between these various powers. If we move a level below that, we go to the level of the little kings, the Palayakarars, including the Tevar of Ramnad, where we have the same kind of ambiguous relationship between overlord and let's call it vassal. These vassals are very independent-minded and supposed to hand over tribute at times to the state, to their overlords. But it's a very contentious relationship. So this period is it's a period of instability, of contention. And this is the context in which the VOC, the Dutch East Indian Company, moves. And like I said, at times there are attempts to form alliances, to bring in the Dutch East India Company in this South Indian Game of Thrones, perhaps. But at the same time, the VOC is never willing to fully commit to this. It has its own agenda. So that's kind of the dynamics that take place here.
And the other thing you mentioned, that you do draw some parallels between the Dutch and the Portuguese in South India. So,
right.
I mean, how much of all this was an attempt to, you know, get an edge over the Portuguese? Because by this time, the Portuguese were clearly in decline.
Right. So the Dutch, in 1658, militarily, they expel the Portuguese. Well, what are the Portuguese? Of course, Portuguese, Estado da India. So after 1658, that part of the Portuguese presence is no longer there. But there's another kind of Portuguese presence, and that at least for a little while continues to worry the Dutch. And that, of course, we have the Estado on the west coast of India, and that's taken care of by 1663 with the conquest of the Portuguese settlements along the Malabar coast. But what remains are various remnants, one could say, in the interior. We have the Jesuit Madurai mission. And So that is sort of a part of the continuing Portuguese presence. And along the coast, we have these Roman Catholic fishermen, the Farava fishermen, who have converted to Catholicism in the 16th century. And for a while, there are some concerns that this group may serve as fifth columnists, right, for a possible Portuguese return. So for a while, that continues to worry the Dutch East India Company. And I talk about how gradually the Dutch East India Company comes to some kind of agreement. There's a process of rapprochement, gradual accommodation between the Dutch East India Company and the Parava fishermen. And I've written some articles about that too before. But by about 1690 or so, this process of accommodation has basically come to completion. It starts with the lower class members of this group. But with the expansion of the Dutch commercial presence, increasing investments in the area, that allows some of the Parava leadership to act as company merchants, and also in the 1690s, the liberalization of the Indo-Ceylon trade provides further commercial opportunities. And at the same time, the allowance of religious freedom, right, by about 1690 or two. These are important concessions that leads to this process of accommodation. So the Portuguese presence diminishes over time. And one could say 1658 is an important watershed point with the physical conquest of the fishery coast, the Portuguese settlements along the southeast coast, and of course the conquest of Jaffna. And then gradually, with the process of accommodation, with the remnants of what let's call a Portuguese presence, I mean, to what extent were the Paravas Portuguese, to what extent were the Jesuits, the Jesuit mission Portuguese, that's a matter for debate. But if you want to look at that in those terms, Portuguese, that certainly, by the 1690s, that's virtually no longer viewed as a threat.
So, apart from the Portuguese, what is wondering, was there anything like, you know, peculiar, rather unique in the nature of the Dutch interaction with Madurai? Because, I mean, for example, if you have all the coastal kingdoms, I mean, and the Dutch would first have encountered them, you know, in a commercial sense, I mean, it wouldn't have been planned, you know, it's just they landed and these kingdoms were there.
Mm-hmm.
But these embassies were, you know, planned, I mean, for the first engagement was a formalized one.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it actually, I mean, make a difference in the way, you know, relations played out.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting question, and it's one of my future projects. What I'd like to do, and I've started on that, is to compare the embassies of the Dutch East India Company throughout the Indian Ocean, right? And one of the things that the Dutch East India Company itself already realized was that there are differences in their relative position throughout the Indian Ocean. So basically, they recognized three kinds of statuses, categories. One of them were areas where they traded by right of conquest, where they had jurisdiction, where they had relatively large territorial possessions. And these were typically governments, where we have a Dutch governor and council in charge. One could think perhaps about the governor of Ceylon, perhaps is the best example. A second category were areas where the Dutch traded by virtue of exclusive contracts, where they had concluded monopolistic agreements with indigenous rulers. So perhaps one could think about Malabar, right, which was a commandment, where we had a commander in charge. One can think about the tin districts of Malaysia or the pepper-producing areas along the west coast of Sumatra, right? So this was the second area. And then there was a third area where the Dutch traded like any other trader, where they resided at the sufferance of indigenous rulers, right? And, of course, this would be the case in areas controlled by the Mughal Empire, by the Safavids, One can also think about Japan, of course. So the VOC itself realized that there were differences in its relative position, what it could achieve and what it could do. Now, where does Madurai fit in this? And that's an interesting question, because the Dutch themselves were not entirely sure what they would like to see, of course, and what they argued was that Madurai, at least the coastal position, the coastal areas, belonged to the Dutch by right of conquest. Right? They had expelled the Portuguese in 1658, so for them that was clear proof that this was by right of conquest, and that therefore they also took over the rights and privileges that the Portuguese previously had enjoyed. To some extent, that's wishful thinking as well. I mean, this is what they would like, and that's what they would like to have the Nyaka authorities recognize in various Olai's letters, official letters. And in order to solidify that, that's why they would like to have a fortified settlement, which they eventually get in 1682, when things are really messy along the coast, when the central authorities of Madurai lose control, actually, over the coast because of an invasion from Mysore. And it's when the Dutch decide to fish in troubled waters and they actually fortify their settlement, 1682. Not with the approval, right, of the Nyaka coast, because that's anything what they would like to see. So that's what they want. Technically, they would like to see the Madurai coast, their possessions there, as falling under their first category. And at times, they assign the title of director, or excuse me, commander, to the head of the Dutch settlements along the Madurai coast. At the same time, they realize that what we have here is sort of a shadowy authority, a dual authority, that there are competing jurisdictional claims, that they are certainly not the sole possessor and controller of the Madurai coast. And I think that's also why they realize they have to send out these embassies to get permission from the Madurai authorities to substantiate these claims in their mind, right, that they have created this idea of by right of conquest. What I'd like to do in this next project is to place sort of these embassies in a larger comparative context of the Dutch Indian Ocean world, where there are interesting, of course, important similarities in the agenda, and that's why we see also the similarities in the agenda between the 1668, 1677, 1689 mission, because typically the VOC is a political merchant who'd like to have certain prerogatives, commercial political prerogatives, to support its position. And that agenda is of course the same throughout the Indian Ocean. However, of course, the margin of operations differ from area to area, and that's what they realize. Right?
So what was the Madurai reaction? I mean, in the sense that they'd already probably dealt with the Portuguese in this capacity, and now they were, you know, dealing with the Dutch. So wouldn't their earlier experience, you know, with the Portuguese have influenced their, mm-hmm. you know, reception of the Dutch?
Well, preferably, and the Dutch are told that repeatedly, the Dutch should behave like merchants, right? And that's where their value belongs, too, of course. As merchants, they import large amounts of bullion. That's typical for this time period, right? The bullion for goods, or in this case, the bullion for textiles model. The only thing that Europeans before the Industrial Revolution really have to offer to India and China is bullion. And so that, of course, is to the great benefit of the Madurai state. It is important for its fiscal system, the minting, the coinage, the currency, and, of course, it generates wealth to the inhabitants that can subsequently be taxed, right? So they fully value the usefulness of the Europeans and the Portuguese, but later, of course, the Dutch as investors, as merchants, generating wealth to the area. Also as importers of curiosities, right? Products, commodities, animals, etc., from faraway places that can serve as important status symbols, right? Exotica, to rulers. And, of course, the physical presence of an embassy itself is already a status symbol, right? For these rulers. So, apart from that, of course, the import of war materials. Right? Repeatedly, the Dutch East India Company and other Europeans are approached to provide either soldiers or war materials to the Nayaka state. So there's certainly an awareness of the usefulness of these Europeans. But as I said, the important precondition is that they should behave like merchants. Right? They should know their place. So the Dutch are viewed as kind of unruly, powerful merchants. A model, a template that already exists, a pre-existing template, is that of the Bandit King. And I make that point in the introduction. That perhaps the position of the Dutch can be compared to some extent with the groups such as the Maravas or Kalars, who are sort of on the outer frontier of sedentary society, and in fact the Madurai coast can be considered somewhat of an outer frontier, and that build up positions as, in some cases, as little kings, and that who provide protection. In this case, the Dutch one could think of as controlling the maritime trades, selling safe conducts, passes, to indigenous traders, and eventually managed to establish a port, just like the Palayakarars, just like the little kings, right? So I think in the end there's a certain pre-existing model or pre-existing models, more than one, in which the Europeans can be fitted, right? If you think about merchants, and perhaps you can also think about the merchant guilds, perhaps in the medieval period, that perhaps is a model. The Europeans do not fit perfectly in these models, of course. There's something different about them too, but somehow you can make this work, right? If you stretch it a little bit, you can make this work.
How important was the naval element, you know, in forging these alliances? Because a lot of the local rulers, they didn't really have any navy. So a European power, you know, with a powerful navy,
yep,
could probably be useful.
I think the naval element is more important as far as the Tevar of Ramnad is concerned, compared to the, relatively speaking, to the Nayakas of Madurai. The state of Ramnath, the Tevars of Ramnath, was much more dependent and connected with maritime affairs compared to, relatively speaking, to the Nayaka state. This in the end will lead to armed conflicts, one in 1685 and 1690 between the Dutch and Ramnath, where the Tevars, the rulers of Ramnath, use a Muslim political merchants, the Piriatambi Marakayars, to further their own maritime interests. They have certain commodities to offer, the chunks, and of course textiles. And what is interesting is, of course, that rulers such as the Tevas of Ramnath officially profess that they have no interest in profits, right? This anti-commercial ethos that officially exists. But he considers this an important status symbol. So that's why he wants to... he actually owns a number of ships that he sends out to Bengal, to Aceh, etc. And he realizes he needs safe conducts, passes from the Dutch, right, in order not to be harassed. He's vulnerable there. So the Tevars do not have their own navy. The Nayaka state doesn't have its own navy. So they realize that, at least on the open seas, they are dependent on these Europeans. But what they learn that to play this game is to play off Europeans against each other. And that's why, in the end, this entire effort by the Dutch, which they take over, which they copy from the Portuguese, right? The Cartagena system, the Cartagena Capilla system. why this whole effort fails. Because if you can't get a safe conduct from the Dutch, well, you can always get one from the English or the French. And what you do as a company official, Dutch East India Company official, and you encounter a ship with an English safe conduct or a French safe conduct, well, there's not much you can do because of repercussions in Europe, right? So they learn to play this game, right? And when they ask, and the Tevar is very good in this, when they ask for a safe conduct, etc., they let it known implicitly that if you don't give us this, then we'll go to somebody else, right? And in the end, after a lot of sputtering and the protesting, etc., the Dutch always come forth with a safe conduct or a passport for these ships. But there's no navy. So if you think about it, that's why in the Dutch Ramnath Wars, if you can call them wars, 1685 and 1690, the Dutch clearly have the mastery of the sea. Right? There's really nothing that these indigenous rulers can do against it, and as far as direct maritime power, naval power. There are other ways to balance the maritime supremacy. Right? And that's why historians have talked about the balance of blackmail, perhaps. That's one term that is used. Right? The Europeans, certainly in the open seas, have a maritime supremacy, but on land, they're vulnerable. Right? I believe that's Ashindas Gupta. And Europeans realize that. That's why conflicts, for the most part, tend to be limited. Right? Another term, the age of contained conflict. Sanjay Subramanian used that term. So the conflicts typically, and this is typical for the wars that take place, the Dutch wage a war against Madurai in 1669, the Tuticorine War, and they have two armed conflicts with the state of Ramnath, 1685-1690. They're all short-term conflicts, right? They're relatively quickly settled because both parties realize they can't afford to escalate this. I mean, they both have their own vulnerabilities. No naval counterparts, to make a long story short, to counteract this.
So you mentioned that this book was a part of your doctoral research. So, I mean, what are you currently working on? I mean, what's the broader context of your research?
Yeah, so what I'm working on now, and it's in a fairly far stage of completion, is to transform that dissertation research into the next book project. And what that does is to provide an overview of the relationship between the Dutch and the Nayaka state of Madurai from its inception. 1645 is when the Dutch established a trading settlement at Kailpatnam along the southeast coast of India, until about 1690. So it appeared for about 4.5 decades. And what the book does is to distinguish certain sub-periods in this interaction. 1645, the establishment of the trading settlement is kind of premature. Conditions are not yet ripe yet. The Portuguese are still too firmly entrenched. So they're actually, in 1649, the Dutch are expelled from their trading settlement, from Kailpatnam. They try to wreak revenge, right? Because you can't let this happen without damaging your reputation. So they send out a punitive expedition, etc. But they don't really reestablish themselves until 1657. So that's the first period of interaction in the sub-period. This period from 1645, the first settlement, till about 1657. Then the next period is from 1658, when they expel the Portuguese from the fishery coast, the Madurai coast, till about 1669, the Tuticorine War, the war between the Dutch and Madurai, short-term conflict. It's during this time period when you see tensions gradually build up When both parties pursue aggressive policies, this is the context of the first embassy of 1668, of Andrei de Mission. And that sort of culminates in this open conflict in 1669. So that's when temporarily the Madurai coast assumes a central position in both horizons, in on both sides, whereas normally it's sort of a secondary theater for both parties. But temporarily, in 1669, it assumes central stage. The third period, it's the period from 1670 to 1679, this is a time period when both parties are going to suffer from overextension, imperial overextension. The Nayaka state gets involved in the conquest of Tanjavur, and they actually temporarily control Tanjavur for 2 years, 1673, 1675. But then there's a powerful backlash against it from various groups, including the Marathas. So the Marathas get involved at this point. Mysore also starts to take over large territories of Madurai in the 1670s. The Dutch East India Company in 1670s has to pay its price for imperial overextension. On the island of Ceylon, and also it gets involved in a series of succession wars in Java. So by the 1670s, late 1670s, this chapter is called The Price of War, both parties basically suffer from this imperial overextension. And this is the context of the second embassy, right? The embassy by Adolf Bussing. In the last chapter, it's the period of the 1680s, from about 1680 to 1689. This is, initially I called this chapter Business as Usual, because this is a time period when seemingly both parties recover from their overextension in the previous decade. But I think I'm going to rename it Splendid Isolation, because what happens is that during this period, the 1680s, there are larger forces at work that gradually overtake both Madurai and the Dutch East India Company. Right? We have the escalation of the Mughal-Maratha conflict, and we also have, on the other hand, the English and the French start to penetrate what the Dutch until that time considered their own sphere of interest. So even though there's a seeming recovery by the late 1680s, there are indications that gradually things are about to change. So that's sort of what I'm working on now. This is sort of the larger historical context of this 4.5 decades of interaction. Whereas the previous book, the present book that we're discussing here now, is just focusing on some episodes in this interaction, but that can be used as etching points, measuring stones for this relationship.
That was fascinating. But we've taken up a lot of your time, so we won't keep you any longer. But if you have any other publications, we'd be very glad to have you talk to the New Books Network again. In the meantime, thanks very much for talking to us. Goodbye.
Thank you, Dara. It was a pleasure.
So, Fox, a fantastic talk about an Indo-European engagement that is often ignored in favor of the dominant discourse on Indo-English engagement. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.